We're live.
It's not.
I don't know.
Okay.
So was our crisis developed?
You ready? Okay. We'll call the Senate
Health and Human Services Finance Division together for Wednesday, February 18th. We have four bills on our agenda today. We'll start out with Senate File 59. Senator Claussen, welcome back to the committee. We've missed you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 59, requesting a $490,000 appropriation to the nonprofit organization Advocating Change Together. The appropriation request is for training, programming, outreach, and administrative costs that my two colleagues to the right will expound upon in just a few minutes. For 35 years, Advocating Change Together has been assisting and advocating for Minnesota citizens with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Advocating Change Together empowers people living with disabilities to take control of their lives with the goal to improve the quality of life for those living with disabilities in the least restrictive work and living environments. And at this time, I'd like to call on Mary Kay Kennedy, co-director of Advocating Change Together, and she will be followed by Rick Cardenas. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Claussen. Before we call on Ms. Kennedy, I'll point members to, there is a packet that covers both proposals in members' packets if they're interested, and let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Ms. Kennedy, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lori and members of the committee, for this opportunity to highlight the work of Advocating Change Together. My name is Mary Kay Kennedy, and I am the executive director. We had the opportunity in 2013 to testify in front of this committee to address our last agency appropriation request. At that time, I explained the statewide work we do to help people with disabilities through our Self-Advocate Minnesota network. I also talked about our peer training programs, and I talked about the leadership role that Advocating Change Together plays on the metro and state level, as well as national and even international. Included in your folders is our 2014 annual report, which highlights the work that we've done over the year in 2014, and it introduces a new program called the Olmsted Academy. As we have been given testimony on, the Olmsted decision put significant demands on our state's resources. ACT has developed a statewide training program to build leaders. A recent evaluation of our agency's capacity highlights our ability to collaborate with others. This was noted as a strength by stakeholders. We provide grants to Greater Minnesota ARC chapters. We work with ARC Minnesota. We work with the Metro Center for Independent Living here in St. Paul. We have relationships with Department of Human Services, University of Minnesota, Governor's Planning Council on Developmental Disabilities, as well as the Disability Law Center. We have been a community advocate and leaders on issues of transportation, employment, and raising awareness of the concerns of people with developmental and intellectual disabilities since 1979. It is work that is never ending and ever fulfilling. I am here today to speak to Senate File 59, which is an agency appropriation for $490,000 over the biennium to cover costs with delivery of services through the statewide network. These costs in the past were covered by DEED, Department of Employment and Economic Development, which ended in 2012. In 2013, we were granted a one-time appropriation to cover cost. We are grateful for the support of our past requests and assure you that we are good stewards of public money. The money that we are requesting, we're dividing into three categories. We're asking for $120,000 for delivery of program and evaluation. So these funds are used for our train-the-trainer program, direct support of human service or human rights training programs, and for curriculum development. If you look in our annual report on page 6 and 10, you'll find out more about these programs. They are offered throughout the state and focus on peer-to-peer training, education access, employment, housing, transportation, and voting. We are committed to evaluation as part of our self-improvement efforts to assure that the methods we're using are actually making improvements of the lives of persons with disabilities. The second area that we're asking for funds in is $280,000 for outreach activities. These funds support our role in providing conferencing and disability networking. We host a variety of state gatherings utilizing our SAM network, and we also attend and participate in regional conferences throughout the state. If you see page 8 and 9 of the annual report, you'll be able to see a little bit about how we facilitate meetings big and small to help our members stay connected, keep informed, and work for individual and collective power. What we intend to do with this $280,000 as well as to establish grants with greater Minnesota regions to enable them to increase their outreach to persons working in segregated settings. The Olmstead decision calls for people with disabilities to have access to information regarding the exploration of more integrated work settings. So each of five Minnesota regions will receive a grant through ACT or through this appropriation, as well as a structured training program to reach out to 100 people in their area. Each region will provide tools, resources for people to explore options, plan for supports, and take action to move from segregated settings to community settings. These subgrants will go to the self-advocate chapters in Duluth, Cambridge, Mankato, Rochester, and Bemidji. Finally, we will be working on the development of community inclusion training materials accessible to people with cognitive, sensory, and physical disabilities. These are all things mandated through the Olmstead decision. And finally, we are requesting $90,000 for indirect expenses and operating. So these funds would be used to help cover administrative associated with managing the facilities, program delivery, staff, and technology. In addition to the basic administrative supports, the funds will be used to enable ACT to continue to explore earned income opportunities. We will also use these funds to work with MAP from a nonprofit to continue to explore administrative partnerships that have potential to reduce administrative and overhead costs and increase our capacity for program delivery. If you turn to page 11 of our annual report, you'll find our financial report. The report highlights that almost $200,000 goes up through ACT to host agency contracts to serve people in greater Minnesota. Despite a small office, our agency has a statewide service area and our demands are growing. As the Olmstead decision implementation plan makes demands on your budget, it also makes demands on ours as well. We are working collaboratively with other agencies to address the needs of our citizens, employers, and families. I am happy to take questions and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. I understand Mr. Cardenas has some testimony as well. Maybe we'd take that and then questions. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Cardenas, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lurie and members of the committee. I'm Rick Cardenas, also with ACT. I just would like to address the funding that we received 2 years ago. Mary Kay has stated it pretty clearly on what we've done with that, but Self-Advocates Minnesota is a statewide network that was created over 6 years ago with funds again from the state, and we see it functioning as extremely strong and bringing self-advocates into decision-making about the quality of their life. And our training programs that we've previously run throughout the state, we were running out throughout the state presenting workshops on self-advocacy, and now with our SAM network established and very strong, they are providing much of that work, and that's where many of the funds will go to enhance that and create that. With the small amount of funds that we were providing, we had people working only part-time, and as many folks know, out there in the rural areas, much of the funds were going to travel from one spot to another spot. The traveling distances are very great. And over the years, the experience and knowledge that we've gained have all been presented in various workshops that we have distributed throughout the state and used still here in the Twin Cities. However, now with the decision from Judge Frank and the Jensen decisions, we again see that the demands will be strong on the state and the Department of Human Services, DEED, and all of them, and we hope to help solve that problem by presenting some of our workshops throughout the state. The judge's ruling wants to see measurable outcomes, and that's what we're about, trying to present and bring measurable outcomes. We're just here to help, okay? So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So a couple of things on the bill as we work through this. We've had several discussions about the need to do better in supporting individuals with that we support in the most integrated setting, you know, in accordance with their needs and their desires, really. And there's going to be many proposals before us, and so we have to have some conversations about you know, how this is coordinated with other efforts. I mean, I know that, you know, the Region 10 or the Statewide Quality Council has a lot of similar activities that they'd like to accomplish. I know that the Olmsted Cabinet, you know, is also wanting to move forward in this direction. And what we have before us is a grant directly to, you know, one entity that has a very good track record with us on this committee. We are all, I believe, familiar with ACT's good work in this area, but we need to talk about that a little bit and make sure that whatever resources we have are coordinated so that we have the best rollout and implementation of the Olmsted Plan. Maybe you could discuss that just a little bit.
Absolutely. So we do work with ARC Minnesota and the ARC chapters, and we're fully in support of the Region 10 quality assurance measures. The way I kind of look at this, and maybe we could talk with some of the folks from the ARC as well to make sure we're coordinating it appropriately, but a lot of the work that ACT does is front-end work. So it's work as people are thinking of, I want to get into this service, or I want to do something different in my life. So it's bringing them to that point. And then once they are receiving those services, it's my understanding it's the quality control efforts that help evaluate, are they really working? So I think there's a place for self-advocacy training throughout that process, but in terms of how it kind of interfaces with quality, the Quality 10 program, or Region 10, I see it as us being a little bit more front-end and them evaluating as the program is taking place.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that as far as, you know, thinking broadly and trying to coordinate all these programs and making sure that we get our best bang for the buck here. My question, I think actually to you, Mr. Chair, is, or to Ms. Kennedy, is the grant over the years has been funded through DEED, which ended in 2012. So is this something that it says here in this folder right here? Mm-hmm. These costs over the years had been funded through a grant through DEED, which ended in 2012-13. They were granted a one-time appropriation to cover costs. So I'm just wondering if we should get DEED involved.
You know, that's a really great suggestion. Let me ask Ms. Kennedy.
Yes. We had a longstanding relationship with DEED where we would go across the state and provide employment workshops just to help people understand what their choices were and improve employment outcomes. And then DEED was very interested in seeing us develop a network that where it wasn't just Rick and I going out every place, you know, establish a network where we could deliver our trainings in a more effective and efficient way. So they really were instrumental in helping us establish this Self-Advocacy Minnesota network, which has been tremendously successful and effective. In 2012, tell me if I'm saying this right, but the priorities of DEED changed, and it changed to competitive grants. And those, we were not competitive for the grants because what we were doing with self-advocacy was not anywhere written in their stated goals. So that was the kind of the reason that they said, you know, we're happy with your services, we love your programs, but it's no longer a fit with how we are doing business here. And then we came in 2013 and asked for a one-time appropriation to kind of replace those funds in a way.
And Ms. Kennedy, where was that appropriation? Was that also through deed or was that through
that
our
was
division?
Through your division.
That's what I thought. Well, if deeds priorities changed, I mean, maybe we could relook at deeds priorities and support your work. I mean, you know, I think we'll have to have these discussions. I mean, honestly, we really have to take a careful look and make sure that whatever we do, we are all committed to the best, most meaningful rollout of the Olmsted plan that we can see within the confines of limited budget constraints. And so we'll be having those discussions. We do value ACT's history and work, and I'll be talking with Senator Tomasoni a little bit, see if we can talk about priorities through deed a little. But this is well taken. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 59 be recommended to pass and rolled over into the finance bill.
Laid over for possible inclusion.
Laid over for possible inclusion.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye. Wait a minute. Anybody else in the public wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 59? A little bit rusty here. This is our first bill. Takes a second. Seeing none, on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you.
Next is Senate File 36. Senator Hoffman, welcome to the committee. Senate File 36.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 36, legislation to appropriate money for training. It's a train-the-training program that will furtherance of the Olmsted Plan and the Olmsted decision, as you know, is a Supreme Court decision in 1999. With me at the table, she's been here, Mary Kay Kennedy, and then also Steve Peck is here. But before I go into specifics of the bill, I just want to get a quick overview of the Olmsted. Once again, just so we're hearing, the Olmsted Plan, the Supreme Court decision requires the state of Minnesota to establish the greater integration and inclusion for people with disabilities. That means people living, working, and participating in life in the most integrated settings possible. That includes employment, housing, transportation, the supports and services, lifelong learning and education, health care and healthy living and community engagement. All that fits in. Advocating Change Together, as you know, is a nonprofit that has a history of doing good services, and it's really run by people with disabilities. Their core group is the folks out there in the field that are getting those SAMS groups and those regional activities together. So they organize people with disabilities to work together to challenge, especially the barriers that are faced. Senate File 36 will appropriate in 2016 and 2017 $377,000 in Health and Human Services budget so that ACT provides training to self-advocates to advance the goals of the Olmsted Plan. The funding is itemized in the language described in. Most of the funds, Mr. Chair, you'll see will be awarded as subgrants to facilitate the implementation of the Olmsted Plan throughout the state. Those will be those train-the-trainer pieces that I talked about earlier. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn the table over to Mary Kay and Steve.
Ms. Kennedy, welcome back.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Chair Lori and members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak to you about a new program that has been developed by Advocating Change Together. The Minnesota Olmsted Plan calls for leadership of people with disabilities to meet court-ordered mandates. In response to this need, ACT has developed a training program called the Olmsted Academy. The goal of the program is to create a culture within Minnesota where self-advocacy is a foundational piece in the state's Olmsted Plan, and people with disabilities are playing meaningful roles in its implementation. In your folders on the right side, you will find a few pages of the Olmsted Facilitator Guide Manual. So these pages are the pages that just highlight the key features of the program and talk about the goals and the method. On the left side of your folder is the ACT annual report, and on pages 4 and 5, that also gives a little snapshot of what the Olmsted Academy is all about. I will very briefly address some of the program features, but invite you to look at the materials in your packet for more information. ACT received a grant from the Otto Bremer Foundation to develop and host the Academy. The pilot class started in September 2014 with 24 participants from across the state of Minnesota. Through experiential learning activities, participants learned all about the history and the goals of Olmsted, and each of the participants had the opportunity to work with others to create a plan for increasing community inclusion in their communities. So this program isn't a training program where people go and learn stuff and then go home and don't do anything. They're making a commitment on the front end that if they're to participate in the program, they are going to be implementing a project in their community. As a result of the program, self-advocates have found their voice and increased personal and group power. The 21 participants are excited and ready to lead and educate their communities, elected officials, social service organizations, and business leaders, not only about their rights, but the rights of everyone with a disability. They walked or rolled away from the Academy knowing the importance of the Olmsted Plan, along with increased confidence, stronger voice, and some solid leadership skills. Each team is implementing an action learning plan, and in your folder, again, on the right side is a copy of the Access Press newspaper, and on page 8 of that paper, the Olmsted Academy is featured. So you could look there, and the author kind of just explains what some of the projects are that are happening across the state. So this year's class is set to address systematic barriers and issues surrounding employment, housing, community involvement, and transportation. So now I would like to turn it over to one of the program participants, Steve Peck, who will tell you more about the Academy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me this opportunity to speak to you about what the Olmsted Academy is, well, means to me as a community leader. Being a part of the Academy was an extremely positive experience for me. It gave me the skills and confidence and know-how to help my peers find a way to be a bigger part of their communities and to get more of what they want out of life. At the Academy, we talked about the fact that everybody benefits when everyone is included. I believe that with all my heart, and I'm proud to be part of it. I even created this logo I'm wearing today. It captures the spirit of what the Academy is all about, disability, pride, and power. I am a person with a disability. The problem for me has not really been the disability itself. My problems have come more from how society treats me. I have suffered discrimination, harassment, and a lot of other things I will not go into right now. I joined the Olmsted Academy to figure out how to work for human rights in my community. Not only for myself, but I wanted to help other people figure out how to live the lives they want to live as well. And that's what we call peer-to-peer support. The Academy and ACT helped me feel supported and respected when they helped me see that I am not a problem needing to be fixed. I can work to make society better for everyone, including me. I will tell you a few things about the Academy. It's a 12-month training program. Academy graduates are leaders working in teams to help other self-advocates become more involved in community life. When we apply to be part of the Academy, we needed to promise to pull together a community council to help us zero in on a project that makes sense in our community. Because this community council helps us plan and implement our project. The project my team is working on is to help some of our peers actually implement their person-centered plans. We want to show that with peer supports, people can get more of what they want out of life. Another team picked a project to do outreach to people in shelter workshops. That's an important one, too. The Olmsted Academy included some pretty cool things, like arranging for us to have dinner with Minnesota leaders. I had dinner with an attorney from the Disability Law Center, Mr. Sean Burke. That was pretty cool to meet him and have dinner with him and his wife. Being a leader means being connected, and the Olmsted Academy is helping me do that. One of the things I remember about the Academy was the opening ceremony, and the Honorable Donovan Frank led the opening, and we all revealed the Olmsted vision and read it out loud. Here is what it says. Minnesota will be a place where persons with disabilities are working in the most integrated setting, learning in the most integrated setting, living in the most integrated setting, and enjoying life in the most integrated setting, and we will work together to help this integration happen. I meant every word of it, and when I took the pledge to work together to make an integration happen. Thank you for your time, and thank you for listening to me.
Mr. Peck, thank you for coming in and telling your story. It's much appreciated. Senator Hoffman, does that conclude your presentation?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. Barring any questions, I would like to, for somebody to motion that this Senate file be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and hopefully you'll see that this train-the-trainer program is not a top-down model, Mr. Chair, but it really engages the community to fully live out the emphasis of what Olmsted means to all of us.
Thank you. So we will open it up to questions. I'm going to start with a kind of similar question to my one last time. How does this integrate with everything else? I saw on the last bill that, $280,000 was for providing sub-grants to organizations around the state. If you read down a little bit, to comply with integration mandates, $210,000 of this is sub-grants to regions throughout the state to construct programs to facilitate Olmsted Plan integration mandates. Are these overlapping and duplicative? Are they different sub-grantees? Are they, tell us a little bit more about how these work together.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Lurie. I can answer that. They may go to some of the same host agencies. So the way our network is structured is we have a state with six regions, and each of the regions of our state has a host agency. And those host agencies are small ARC chapters around the state. They coordinate and bring people into the SAM network. So as part of the Olmsted Academy, each of the regions receives about $15,000 to implement an action learning project of their choice. So the idea is, during the Academy, we're asking them, well, what do you think is going to help increase community integration? And let's give that a try and see if it works. So with Steve's group, for example, his team said, we're really concerned that people are having person-centered plans done, and then those plans just get filed and we're not really seeing them be implemented. What would it be like to have a peer-to-peer support program to help people take those plans out of the drawer and move them forward to get more of what they want out of life? So that's one example. Other communities have chosen other action learning projects. The agency appropriation that I gave testimony on just a few minutes ago does include a very similar thing, but it's specifically for outreach to people that are working in sheltered workshops. So we've piloted, or we're piloting now, a program called Explore, Prepare, Act, Finding the Job That You Want. And it's a very structured program where we go into people who are working in the workshops and we help them just understand that there are some other options for them if they're interested in pursuing them. And that because the employment is such a kind of a heavy thing for people, and it's the most frequent thing that we're hearing from self-advocates, and it's a big part of the Olmsted mandate, we thought it would be nice through the agency appropriation just to make sure that all of the regions are doing outreach on employment, where through the Olmsted Academy, one of the region is working on employment, but the other ones have other initiatives.
And then as a proposal to provide a grant to a specific nonprofit, can you tell us what percentage of your operating revenue would be provided by grants in your plan, and how much would be supported through the community. We always like to know the leverage that we're driving. So not just this request, but, you know, your budget, how much is intended to be supported by grants from the state.
And Senator Lurie, are you referring to the entire organization or this specific program?
Maybe both would be helpful.
Okay, so if you looked on page 11 of our annual report, you'll find our Advocating Change Together income and expenses. And it lists out the sources of revenue at the top. So we do receive a grant from the Department of Economic Development, the Governor's Planning Council. So when we look at that money from the Governor's Planning Council, this is a good example of they give ACT the money, and ACT re-grants that to Greater Minnesota. So that's what our position is in the SAM network. And that would hold true for the Department of Human Services. So that holds the money. That's two grants, actually. And one of those grants supports the SAM network, and it supports three regions where Department of Human Services grants money to ACT. And then we establish sub-grants with regions across the state. The grant that's listed here is the grant through Otto Bremer Foundation to pilot the Olmsted Academy. And we've got just, you know, under $30,000 individual concert contributors and sponsors, and then some sales.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
And Mary Kay, you over the grave markers, the 101,000, there are still up to 10,000 unmarked graves in the state of Minnesota. So that really is that's something that needs to be taken care of. And so it really is that just to let people know that money is really dedicated, yep, to making sure that we're remembering with dignity those that were in institutions.
I've got a long history with that bill myself. I've carried it several times.
Senator Lurie, I was just going to mention that.
Yes,
I think your question about diversification of funds is really a good one, that we don't, as a nonprofit, we don't want too much of our money coming from one source. And we really have been working quite hard these last couple years trying to position our organization to launch a public benefit corporation. So we're working, you might know, Tom Triplett is working with us as a volunteer, and we've got some really fabulous community leaders that you'll see on the, let's see what page that is. On page 13, it lists all of our volunteers. And we have this initiative in the bottom right-hand corner is New Mission-Driven Earned Income Venture, and it lists our volunteer and our advisory committee for that. So we are very much hoping within the next several years that our income, our support of our organization will be more balanced, because we do see that we have too much. It's just unbalanced now with public support. And we're very interested in having earned income be a more balanced proportion of our revenue.
Thank you for that. So when I turned to page 11, as you suggested, and I looked at your financials, I see that in your annual report, your financials are unaudited, it says, at the top.
Absolutely.
Do you have an audit?
Well, we always have had. We've had an audit every year. It's early in the year to have an audit, so we don't. We wouldn't have it typically by this time of the year. So our accountant puts this together for us. If we're under $750,000, we're not required to have an audit, and so it's always kind of that balance for us. It costs about $7,000 to audit our organization, so. We're kind of considering with the board and thinking about, is it worth it to have an audit, or should we have a firm come in and do something less than an audit, but it still balances all the books and makes sure everything is clean at the end of the year?
I will have to say that all of the budget chairs have been given instruction, particularly when there are proposals to give a grant directly to an entity, not in a competitive bid process, that we pay careful attention to the audits and the books of the grantees. It's something that is good business practices to make sure that we have what's needed. Again, I mean, ACT is well known to us here on this committee. It has very good reputation, but that is an instruction that we've been given, and I think that we'll be looking to just do a quick review. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and with regard to sort of financial oversight, the 990s are very helpful.
Yep.
There are additional schedules that are included that would give us an idea of a little more in-depth where the spending is happening, and so while we don't have that here, it's something that we can investigate.
Yep.
As we go forward. And Mr. Chair, if I can just have an additional moment, there's a lot of things moving with Olmsted. I don't see sort of a strategic plan, and I don't know if that's because I haven't been engaged enough, but I'd like to have an idea of overall where we're going with Olmsted. We've got a sub-cabinet. We've got people coming forward with ideas, and there's only so much money. And so I would like to see that going forward. And I'd be happy to help in whatever way I can.
Senator Benson, you just said the exact same thing I said at the in the hearing of the first bill. And it's, the point is well taken. We need to have a careful and strategic approach to make sure that our Olmsted implementation is as coordinated as it can be, because we have limited resources. So we'll have to work through that. And there are many folks who are going to be coming before us and saying, you know, our proposal, this is your path through the Olmsted implementation. And, you know, I mean, we'll have to work through that and together work on how we balance all of the needs and make sure that we have the most meaningful rollout of the Olmsted plan. And so you have my commitment. We will be working on that, and I would welcome your assistance as we try to put together that the best approach.
And, Mr. Chair, I apologize for my tardiness causing a review of what you'd already said. So thank you.
Senator Benson, it was actually very healthy, I think, to have it echoed a second time. So no worries. That said, any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I too just want to, I am still a little, I think there's some duplication between Senate File 59 and 36. So, again, when we drill down a little better, I'd like to get that clarified, make sure that we get our, get this out rolling efficiently. So with that, I recommend that Senate File 36 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill.
Okay. Before we take up that motion, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 39? 36, rather. Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Rosen's motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Have a good day.
Next, we have Senator Franzen with Senate File 359. Senator Franzen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to present Senate File 359, a bill that provides an increased annual appropriation of $800,000 in fiscal year 2016, and I do have an author's amendment with regards to 2017, to the Department of Health to fund the Minnesota Poison Control System. Some of you may know that the state statute mandates that Minnesota have one poison center, but it doesn't specifically state how the poison center is to be funded. Hennepin County Medical Center, HCMC, is the current vendor and has built an impressive infrastructure over the last few decades. Unfortunately, with federal funding cuts and insufficient state funding over the last 12 years, HCMC has had to subsidize a statewide program. This is really a statewide program with the Poison Center answering 48,446 calls from all 87 Minnesota counties. I'd like to add some key points that are in your handouts as well, that for every dollar invested in Poison Centers saves more than $13 in medical costs and lost productivity. 91% of the public callers are treated at home with Poison Center assistance and follow-up. And just in 2014, the Poison Center saved Minnesotans $35 million by avoiding unnecessary medical utilization and reducing hospital lengths of stay. And 27,000 unnecessary emergency department visits were prevented just in 2014. So as you can tell, it's a gem that we have in our state, and certainly with changes happening at the federal level in terms of funding, certainly we need to take a closer look at how we sustain the great work of the Poison Control Center and the work that HCMC has done for our state. We have provided an update in your 2015 fact sheet and a map showing the number of calls coming by county and a list of organizations that support this legislation. So you can see there's a lot of hospitals in all of our state regions, and it really is a testament that not only the public uses this system, but also hospitals rely on it for expertise all around our state. I have with me today a few testifiers, including Debbie Anderson, the manager of the Minnesota Poison Control System, to provide you with more detail. I'm not sure when you would like for me to move the amendment as well.
It's an author's amendment. This is the first hearing, so we'll just move. And members, you have the A1 amendment in your package. As Senator Franzen mentioned, this makes the $800,000 an annual appropriation. It is then added to the base. So on Senator Franzen's motion on the A1 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. All right. Senator Franzen, you have the bill in shape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To your testifiers.
We'll start with Ms. Debbie Anderson.
Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Deborah Anderson. I am the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System located at Hennepin County Medical Center. HCMC contracts with the Minnesota Department of Health to fulfill the department's statutory obligation to provide poison control services and information to Minnesota. I want to start by thanking you for the $500,000 increase in base support for the Poison Center that was passed in the legislature in 2013. Those funds are being used to cover critical operating costs and are greatly appreciated. However, our efforts last year to attain funding for the remainder of our budget shortfall were unsuccessful. And this year, HCMC is subsidizing $680,000 of this statewide program, an amount they are unable to continue to provide. We are here to request an $800,000 increase in annual appropriations. These funds would cover the $680,000 shortfall to ensure uninterrupted provision of critical emergency care services and provide $120,000 to restore public education activities and provide public health support for emerging issues like poisonings from e-cigarettes and liquid nicotine. Anyone can call the Poison Center anytime from anywhere in Minnesota. Our 24/7 emergency call center responds to calls from homes, schools, daycare centers, workplaces, and healthcare facilities of all types and sizes across the state. Callers are community members and healthcare providers, including first responders, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and physicians. Our poison information specialists provide immediate, individualized medical assessment, treatment, and follow-up for people of all ages who are exposed accidentally or intentionally to a variety of substances, such as prescription medication, drugs of abuse, household products, chemicals, and plants. In 2014, over 48,000 calls from every county in Minnesota were managed by our highly specialized staff of toxicology experts. Your packet includes a handout with information on calls from your district on the front and a map of the statewide calls by county on the back. Here's the map. The Poison Center saves lives and money. For every dollar spent on Poison Center services, more than $13 in medical costs and lost productivity is saved. In 2014, the Poison Center saved Minnesota taxpayers over $35 million, prevented 27,000 unnecessary emergency department visits, and improved clinical outcomes. 91% of our poison exposures in the home are safely managed at home through consultation with Poison Center staff, thereby preventing unnecessary healthcare visits and crowding of emergency departments. When we survey our callers, 80% say that if the Poison Center wasn't available, they would go to the emergency room or a clinic. The Poison Center provides professional training of physicians, pharmacists, nurses, and pre-hospital providers across the state. We provide valuable training for the Health Partners Physician Toxicology Fellowship at Regents Hospital, which is the only toxicology training program in Minnesota. The Poison Center also provides public education and poison prevention programs for communities across the state. Finally, the Poison Center provides critical public health surveillance, data collection, and response to emerging public health threats. We were first to raise the alarm about synthetic marijuana and about toxic products marketed as bath salts. We also identified health risks associated with highly concentrated laundry detergent pods. We track the incidence of foodborne illness across the state, and we respond to mass exposures from substances ranging from industrial chemicals and pesticides to carbon monoxide. Working with the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation, we're ready to assist callers with opiate overdoses. Partnering with the Minnesota Department of Health, we are summarizing 2014 poisoning data from e-cigarettes and liquid nicotine. We are providing our toxicology expertise to the Health Department's Office of Medical Cannabis as they roll out the new medical cannabis program. Our 24/7 call center, staffed by medical professionals, and our data collection capability are valuable to the public health of all Minnesotans. Failure to fund this $800,000 request will result in a cascade of losses for the Poison Center and for the state of Minnesota. The initial loss of medical education, prevention education, and public health surveillance will be followed by a loss of national accreditation and more than $400,000 of federal funding that is contingent upon that accreditation. Ultimately, the capacity of the 24-hour emergency call center would be reduced. Overall, these losses will increase the demand on our healthcare resources and increase unnecessary healthcare costs. As Senator Franzen noted, we have a broad coalition of supporters from across the state. Professional organizations, hospitals, urgent care centers, emergency departments, and emergency medical services. The coalition handout in your packet shows our supporters, and it's a group that continues to grow. Public support is also strong. Three citizens share their stories and appreciation for the service provided by the Poison Center in their letters included in your packet. The first letter is from James and Haley Thompson, who share their two-year-old daughter's life-threatening experience after aspirating mineral spirits into her lungs, causing severe problems breathing. The Poison Center immediately assisted the family, consulted with the emergency responders, and the treating hospital physician, all contributing to a good medical outcome. The second letter is from Erin Arlinghouse, mother of five, who describes multiple occasions when the Poison Center assisted her in caring for her children at home, saving unnecessary emergency department visits. And the last letter is from Marilyn, who lives in rural Minnesota, who mistakenly took a double dose of her prescription medications. Marilyn was able to safely stay out of the hospital with Poison Center monitoring throughout the day until her symptoms resolved at home. In summary, the Poison Center serves all Minnesotans, saving lives and money. Minnesota needs the Poison Center, and we need your help. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And I know when my kids were little and getting into things, I personally made a call or two and was able to safely manage issues at home, didn't have to, and would have gone to the ER. So it's a personal experience that I really valued. You have another testifier, Senator Franzen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have Dr. Thomas Wyatt, who is the president of the Minnesota chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians, who would also like to testify.
Dr. Wyatt, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. I'm Dr. Thomas Wyatt. I'm the president of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I represent over 600 emergency physicians across our state. I'm here today to urge you to support Senate File 359 and appropriate $800,000 for funding of the Minnesota Poison Control System. The Poison Center responds to calls from the public and providers statewide. While 23% of the callers last year were from healthcare providers like myself, and 77% were members of the public, as an emergency care provider, I can say without a doubt that the Poison Center is a key partner in allowing us to deliver life-saving care for toxicologic cases in our emergency department. The fact that they're available for consultation 24/7, 365 is reassuring to those of us who practice on the front lines of medicine. The Poison Center is cost-effective. By managing over 90% of call-in cases at home without requiring a visit to the ED, Poison Center saved Minnesotans $35 million in health care and lost productivity costs and prevented overcrowding of our state emergency departments. Poison Center provides essential education to emergency and medical professionals in training, including physicians, paramedics, EMTs, first responders, and nurses. It would be impossible to find an emergency care provider in our state that doesn't have one or many stories about how the Poison Center helped them manage a toxicology case. Poison Center provides community services as well, including community education and the surveillance of emerging public health threats, such as drugs of abuse and tainted medications and products. Finally, the failure to fund the Poison Center would trigger a cascade of losses, including loss of education funds, loss of community prevention education, and the limited capacity of the all-important 24-hour emergency call center. Many of the most serious toxicologic cases are extremely time-sensitive and require immediate feedback from the Poison Center. So any disruption in the call center staffing could result in a public safety issue. I once again urge you to support funding for the Poison Control Center, and thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you, Dr. Wyatt. Thank Senator you. Franzen, I understand you have one more testifier.
I believe I have at least one more from testifier from the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation.
Ms. Holtman, is that correct?
No, it's a different person, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, then correct me. State your name for the record and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jennifer McCourt, and I'm the administrator at the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation. You may recognize our name because we at the foundation worked hard last year to have an army of citizen lobbyists here at the Capitol to talk with you about Steve's Law, the Minnesota 911 Good Samaritan and Naloxone Law. The citizens' work was successful, and the law passed through both chambers unanimously. The chief author in the Senate was Senator Chris Eaton. We're very grateful for her efforts in this legislation. Since the enactment of Steve's Law, we have heard of numerous calls to 911 to save lives as a result of the caller knowing they would receive immunity, and numerous overdose reversals from the wider access to naloxone as well. You acted to save lives, and it's working. As a mom of a child who suffers from the chronic, often fatal disease of addiction, I thank you. We at the Foundation are proud to partner with the Poison Center. The Poison Center does play a role in reducing loss of life to substance abuse and addiction. In 2014, the Poison Center took close to 1,500 calls related to intentional substance abuse. Almost 90% of these cases needed medical management in a healthcare facility and ongoing involvement of the toxicology expertise that the Poison Center provides 24/7. Substance abusers or their family or friends call when they are dealing with serious medical emergencies. They don't call when the experience was pleasurable. They only call when things go very wrong. So we at the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation believe that the Poison Center's role is critical in saving lives. We are currently partnering with the Poison Center and Hennepin County Medical Center to provide naloxone kits to patients who are treated in both the emergency department and HCMC's methadone clinic. These are the kits we're providing. There's information on the Poison Center right on the outside and also included on the inside so people can call. Naloxone is the benign, non-narcotic, non-addictive overdose reversal medication for which we fought so hard last year for wider access to all Minnesotans. Included in the kits, as I said, is the Poison Center contact information, so anyone who may need assistance may call. We at the Foundation believe this is a vital step in saving more lives in this opioid epidemic we're fighting. We are proud of our partnership with the Poison Center. We are all dedicated to stemming the tide of opioid overdose deaths in the state of Minnesota. We ask you to stand with us and support this appropriation bills to keep the momentum going.
Thank you, Ms. Court. Senator Franzen, did you have...
I think we are done with testifiers. Sure. I just want to thank co-authors of the bill, Senator Rosen, Hayden, Hoffman, and Eaton as well, for supporting this bill. And as you can, you've heard, this is a very critical part of our health care delivery system in the state. And sometimes we expect it to be there, but we don't realize that we have to actually support it as well. So I ask for your support, and I have no further testimony, and if I stand for questions.
I have a couple of questions. So last year, we were successful in securing $500,000, correct?
Correct.
In the base appropriation, and so this would be an additional $800,000, bringing the total appropriation to $1.3 per year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, but it's 2013 when we appropriated the...
Last biennium, yes. So if I recall correctly, back in 2013, the total request was for $1 million per year, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's 1.3. You know, if you'd been successful, would that $1 million have done it? I mean...
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll have Ms. Anderson elaborate on the funding mechanism because, as I mentioned earlier, there has been some dry-up funds from the federal government that we relied on before, and now that's a gap existing there, but there's also more to it. So I'll have Ms. Anderson elaborate on the funding piece.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so initially in 2013, I believe our funding request was $1 million for the first year and then $1.5 ongoing for the second year. We have had a decrease of 36% in our federal funding that occurred in 2011 that helped get us to where we are today. And we've also had a change in the national accreditation criteria for the program, and it results in a little bit more staffing that we need to maintain to do that. And the reason that accreditation is so important to us, it allows us to receive $400,000, a little more than that, of federal funding each year. So all of those things together meet our request for $800,000 this year.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. And for correcting my memory, sometimes it works, sometimes, you know, not perfectly. Can we request that you follow up with us with a detailed budget of this budget activity so that we can have that, you know, we'll distribute it to members as well? Not for all of HCMC that operates the poison control, but for the poison control itself, and just for us to be able to have that to review, that would be helpful. Is that something you can follow up?
Mr. Chair, I have it right here, so we'll make sure that everybody has a copy.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad we broke that down, too, because that wasn't part of my question. But to either Senator Franzen or Ms. Anderson, or perhaps Dr. Wyatt, the national accreditation standards have changed, and they lowered your match or your funding from the feds, and they changed your standards. I think that's really too bad. I don't know if you want to respond to that, but I just kind of Googled the Minnesota poison control number, the toll-free number. That is apparently nationwide. How do you get the number out without having to, if I was a parent and had to Google it, I'd be a mess. How do you advertise and how do you get that number out?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that's a great question. Most of it is through public education. And that's where we've actually made the cuts over the last several years to kind of meet the budget, if you will. So we probably aren't doing as good of a job getting the number out there without the education efforts that we've had in the past. But they're available through those programs, all of the professional teaching we do, as well as on stickers and magnets and things that you can order right off the website.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I feel strongly about this bill, obviously, but I do hope that the training for our providers is efficient, especially on the substance abuse. I know that there's more training that needs to be to our medical community on substance abuse and poison. So this is, I think, well-deserved dollars that go to the appropriate place. HCMC.
Excellent. I think Senator Benson and then Senator Hurst. Senator Benson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Anderson, you talked about reporting on like foodborne illnesses, things like that. Is that just data that you're collecting from your calls and it rolls up to the Department of Health, or we're not having scope creep issues, are we?
Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benser, we provide, for foodborne illness specifically, when public callers call into the Poison Center and need help on a Saturday night managing what they believe is foodborne illness, we provide that management. Most of the time are able to keep them in their home and give them criteria that they need to fulfill if they're going to go into a healthcare facility. But most of the time we can manage it. We communicate with the health department daily and provide those foodborne illness cases, and they do the medical follow-up and looking to see and piecing it together with the other data that the health department has. So we are contributing to their program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Herr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I will support this bill. I think it's a good bill. But I just have just some specific question. I represent a very diverse district, and majority of, I would say, my constituents don't speak English as their primary language. That's the Poison Center provided that, and at the same time, they're receiving call through the multilingual line.
Mr. Chair and
Ms. Anderson,
Senator Herr, that's a great question. We use a translation service that's available so anyone can call the Poison Center, and that's actually provided with our federal funding as part of that program. We also try to do some outreach to the non-English speaking communities as well, and that's been one of the places where we have seen some decreases in our budget. That public education dollars that we've reduced unfortunately have affected that area as well, but we serve all communities.
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Herr.
I just want thank you. It's a great answer, and I just wonder, are you receiving calls from, you know, what's the percentage of, are you receiving call from parents that don't use English as their primary language, and what's that number? I know that there's overall number in Ramsey County and Hinneman County, and those are great number, but are you using, do folks using that service?
Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Senator. I don't have those numbers with me today. We do get monthly reports of how many times we have used that language line and what languages are used. I can tell you that our most common language, non-English language, is Spanish. But we do receive calls each and every month from other communities as well. I'd be happy to provide those numbers if they would be helpful. They are fairly low. I mean, it's hard to get the message out to, you know, English-speaking Minnesotans, and when you start talking the non-English-speaking, it's more difficult.
Thank you.
Any follow-up?
I'm good.
Okay. Yeah. Ms. Anderson, we have the budget sheet passed out, and I guess it leads to an additional question. I mean, 1.6 is what it says here from the state, and there must be something I'm missing. I mean, I thought, tell me where the 1.6 from the state comes. I was aware of the $500,000 that we put in in 2013 that's built into the base, but there seems to be more built into the base. And is there anything, or is there an assumption in this that some of this bill gets passed as well, or is this without the passage of this bill? Just describe the state support.
Mr. Chair, I believe our annual appropriation is 1.6 per year through the health department. I believe, or through our state general fund appropriation.
So there must have been 1.1 before we put in the additional 500,000 in 2013 to bring it up to 1.6. I mean, you know, rounding. And so, all right.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And
yes.
If confirm that afterwards and follow up if it's not correct. We'll assume that it is. Oh, we have Dave Greenman with the Department of Health nodded. That is indeed correct. So we don't even need a follow up. That's helpful. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 359? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves that Senate File 359, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further questions of members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Franzen. Last on our agenda is Senator Wicklund with Senate File 551. Senator Wicklund, get yourself together. Maybe let the.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Yes, I'm here today to present Senate File 551. It's part of the Homes for All legislation this year and the strategic investments in housing and services. This bill provides for appropriations for five DHS programs: the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund, the Homeless Youth Act, Housing with Supports for Adults with Serious Mental Illness Grant Program, Transitional Housing Program, and the Emergency Services Program. We know that homelessness is an issue for Minnesotans across the state, with an estimated 14,000 homeless on any given night. And about half of those are people that are under the age of 21. Significantly, one of the fastest growing groups is the two-parent households with children and seniors. Prior to being in the Senate, I was on the school board in Bloomington, and during my time on the Bloomington school board, I became aware of the negative impact that high mobility has on the academic achievement of children in our schools. Reviewing achievement data of highly mobile students versus non-highly mobile students reveals distinctly lower test scores over the highly mobile students' years in school, and these deficits are very difficult to overcome. Beyond test scores, children suffer from a social-emotional toll brought on by frequent moving. One of the ways we can address this is by funding programs that bring housing stability to families' lives. Homes for All is an alliance of over 150 organizations throughout Minnesota representing the entire housing continuum, from homelessness prevention to successful home ownership. Housing underpins many of the core functions of state government. We can increase funding for education and health care, but if people in those systems aren't having their housing needs met by first investing in a continuum of housing and services, we won't realize the full potential of people or impact of programs. We want this continuum to exist statewide and be able to serve people regardless of their circumstances or geography. And now I'd like to have my testifiers speak to the specific programs addressed by this bill. And I'm not sure who wishes to go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, and I'm wearing two hats today, figuratively. One is as the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, and the other as a board member of Hearth Connection. NAMI knows how important it is to have safe, affordable housing with supports when you live with a serious mental illness. And we also believe that the high numbers of people with mental illnesses who are homeless are simply unacceptable. The Housing with Supports for Adults with Serious Mental Illnesses program is excellent, and NAMI strongly supports the increased funding of $5 million for it in Senate File 551. It's not a group home. It's not an institution. It's a home. A home in an apartment building or scattered site where people can obtain the support they need to live well in the community. In 2014, you funded 422 apartment units and 19 housing projects. The housing support services include things such as tenancy support, front desk coverage, and connecting people to mental health services. There can be communal space to break the isolation and even meals if needed. When we look at the log jams in our mental health system, it's a front door and a back door issue. Creating more supportive housing enables people to leave higher cost settings and return to their communities with the supports they need to assist in their recovery. Hearth Connection is an agency that applies for grants on behalf of county collaborations from the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund allocated through DHS. I'm here today to speak in support of the $6.5 million increase contained in Senate File 551. Supportive housing is an evidence-based practice for ending homelessness for people who need services. Currently, the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund is funded at $11.82 million for the biennium. This money provides housing supports in six regional county collaborations, 34 counties in all, including three tribal nations. Currently, none of these funds are allocated to the central and western parts of the state. We know that there are people experiencing long-term homelessness across the state, and I believe the $6.5 million increase to this fund would truly take this program to be statewide. This funding represents an investment in the lives and well-being of children and adults facing tremendous barriers to stability, health, and contributions to their community. On behalf of Hearth Connection, NAMI, and the providers of these programs, many of whom are here today, I hope you will support Senate File 551 by including it in your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Senator Wicklin, would you like your next testifier, Ms.
Yes,
Blance?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Blance. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Blance. Please state your name for the record.
Chair and Senate members. I'm Lee Blanz. I'm the Executive Director of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. And we're a collaborative of 70 congregations committed to ending homelessness. We provide emergency shelter, develop affordable housing, and provide supportive housing in collaboration with our service partners. I'm pleased to speak on behalf of the Homes for All Coalition in favor of $4 million of additional investment in the Homeless Youth Act. It's shocking for most people to learn that on any given night, there are 4,000 youth ages 16 to 21 who are homeless on their own. There's many contributing factors to why a young person becomes homeless, but the simplest explanation is that they think the streets are safer than their own home. This is not just an urban problem. About half of young people who are homeless are looking for a safe place in Brooklyn Park, Bemidji, Belle Plaine, Babbitt, Blooming Prairie, and Burnsville. The Homeless Youth Act provides flexible funding to meet the specific needs of a wide range of communities. Of the 30 organizations funded in 2013, 13 are in Greater Minnesota and 5 are in suburban communities. Together, we're providing 72 emergency shelter beds and 250 transitional and supportive housing opportunities, along with a myriad of street outreach and drop-in services to assist youth from transitioning from homelessness to stability. Addressing homelessness at this critical development period can prevent long-term homelessness, reduce the risk of sexual exploitation and involvement in the criminal justice system, support youth to complete school, and support future taxpayers and entry into the workforce. Beacon has developed Nicollet Square, which is a 42-unit apartment building that's supportive housing. On-site supportive services are provided by our partner, YouthLink. The Homeless Youth Act funding provides a transition coach, which works individually with each youth
to help them with employment, education, and dealing with the trauma of abuse and homelessness. We had a young man, Sean, who spent the weekend preparing his testimony for today and at the last moment got too nervous to speak today, so I will share his story. Sean became homeless at the age of 16. There was so much abuse in his home that he left and ended up out on the streets, sleeping in trains at night and walking the streets during the day. Sean moved into Nicollet Square at the age of 20 after being on our waiting list for a whole year. In the 18 months that Sean has now lived at Nicollet Square, I'm pleased to say that he is now a high school graduate. Sean, like many, about half of the young people who move into Nicollet Square did not have his high school diploma or GED on the time of move-in. With that high school diploma, he can expect that his lifetime earnings will increase by $500,000. Sean is also employed. We have a Work Fast program that subsidizes employment for the first couple of months, and we're able to get young people employed on average within 2 weeks of moving into Nicollet Square. And we have a 95% employment rate at any given time among our young people at Nicollet Square. And as you know, of course, high school is not enough. 42% of our high school graduates are also engaged in post-secondary education. Sean has just completed his first semester of community college, and he hopes to stay at Nicollet Square until he completes his associate degree. He's taken classes in film and actually hopes to create a documentary about youth homelessness so that people can understand the pain and trauma behind homelessness and the power of a home to heal. Sean's story is just one of hundreds that are served by the 30 programs funded by the Homeless Youth Act across the state that help young people like Sean invest in themselves, and all have the significant outcomes seen at Nicollet Square. But there's not enough funding. If you realize that Sean was homeless for 4 years, what if we could have helped him when he was 16? What if we could have helped him when he was 19 and applied to Nicollet Square? Beacon is ready to build youth housing in St. Paul and in Edina, and others are ready to provide those same services throughout the state. But we need your assistance. Together, we can end youth homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blonds.
6 8, 9.
Senator Wicklund, you have one more testifier.
Yes. Please go ahead.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Leslie Sauter with Lakes and Pines Community Action Council. I am the director of the Community Services Department, where we work towards our mission to end poverty, but specifically we deal with homeless programs. And I'm here to share a story about how we utilize two funding sources to help a homeless individual just this last November. The week of Thanksgiving on Wednesday afternoon, a gentleman came into our office stating that he had woken up frozen to the ground that morning, and someone had told him to come to Lakes and Pines. So he hitchhiked to our office and began to tell his story about how he had been homeless for 10 years. We kind of found out through our conversations with him that he had dyslexia, and that is what was preventing him from being able to fill out housing applications, employment applications, and he was merely getting by on general assistance and camping out and couch hopping for the last 10 years. We immediately put him up in emergency shelter, which was a motel in the neighboring town, and we worked with him on applying for housing, and last month we successfully helped him attain employment. So he is now housed and has a job and is no longer sleeping under a pine tree in rural Mille Lacs County. The significance of the story is 5 years ago, our agency would not have been able to do that. We would have had to turn him away because we did not have funding to put him up in emergency housing or transition him from a motel stay into an apartment when he lacked employment. General assistance isn't enough to afford an apartment unless it's subsidized, and those are limited as well. So the funding we received in the last couple of years for transitional housing program as well as emergency services program helped us find him housing and stabilize his situation.
Thank you for your story. It's a different person than we had on the agenda. Could you repeat your name? It surprised us, and I
sure
missed it.
My name is Leslie Sauter with Lakes and Pines Community Action Council.
Thank you.
Yep.
Ms. Sauter. All right. Did you have any other testifiers, Senator Wicklund?
I do not think so.
Okay.
I think that was all the testifiers.
I've been alerted that DHS would have some administrative costs to implement this, and we'll have to put a fiscal note together that we don't have today, but we'll get that and share it with you and members as well. I think we can still take action and lay it over for possible inclusion, but we'll watch for that and see what will come from that. Questions of members? Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I've been looking through this impressive document that tells a bit of the story of the need. What I cannot see is I can see that the appropriation, if approved, would go to the Commissioner of Human Services, and but it's unclear how are these dollars distributed differently throughout the state? How is the Commissioner directed to distribute these programs, these dollars, so that they serve the entire state?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wickman.
Senator Sharon, I think that, as you can see in the bill, the appropriations go to separate programs, and within that, I guess each of them would be able to speak more to how the money gets distributed. I don't know if you'd like to, Ms. Blondes, I don't know if you'd have more to add about your specific area.
Senator Laurie, I just, perhaps Sharon, you could provide that to me rather than try to go through it with testimony, how each of these programs, where the money from each of these programs go, the existing funding plus the additional funding, how that's distributed, how each of these programs are distributed throughout the state.
Chair,
Ms. Blondes.
Thank you. And just to be clear, and there is a little bit of a breakdown on this sheet in terms of the amount of money going to each different program, but there is a competitive RFP issued. And so when we apply for emergency or transitional or homeless youth act, it is compared across the state, and everyone has an opportunity to apply for those funds. And in regards to the Homeless Youth Act, OEO would say that about $10 million of additional good quality programs had applied for the funds but didn't rank high enough given the limited resources. So it is a competitive process.
Thank you. And Senator Laurie, just to follow up, I understand
Senator
that.
Sharon.
So in the end, what happens with that competitive grant and how the money, in fact, is distributed in the past? I might be predictive of what might happen in the future, so if I could see the actual way in which the money is distributed and where it went in the state, that would be helpful to me.
And Senator Sharon, I understand DHS has given us a pretty good breakdown historically, and we will ask them to update that and share it with the committee as well. But if, Ms. Blondes, the sheet that you were showing us that's in the packet, is that what you would provide for the additional detail, or would you be able to provide additional detail beyond what's on that sheet as well, or would you just direct us to that?
thank you, Chair. I would probably direct you to DHS just for the sake
okay.
of accuracy. Yes.
Okay. So we will follow up with DHS and request that they give us that more detailed view that they've done in the past. Other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question and my concern is that it is a competitive grant, and if there are situations where they're not able to fill out the grant, they don't have the resources to fill out the grant, they don't fit that criteria, but there's still a need. So I'm just concerned about a disparity because of a comparative grant process. The resources aren't there to be able to provide the information or whatever it is for these facilities.
Ms. Blond, Senator Wickman, Ms. Blond, your choice.
Chair Laurie, thank you. Senator Rosen, I understand that 40% of the Homeless Youth Act funding went to Greater Minnesota. I guess I'm not sure that I can say, you know, where all of the different grant programs, how it was all distributed, if it was all evenly distributed. I know that one of the testifiers, Ms. Abderholden, testified that the additional funding would allow them to distribute the grants even further, and there are portions of the state that aren't covered that they have intended to cover, but they can't with the current funding. And that was, I think that is in the packet as well, the Hearth Connection, excuse me. They would like to expand in several regions. The Northeast expansion, Central Region expansion, that is also in your handout.
Okay. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding was that it's always been a competitive grant process with regards to these type of allocations that we provide. So I'd like to also know that from the department to just explain how they come up with that list. And my understanding as well is that they also look at some other criteria would encompass the geographic spread of the dollars. So it'd be good to have it for the record for the committee to evaluate how that's distributed. And we can certainly probably put it in legislation that we want to have that to be considered. And I don't have a question. I just have a comment and just to commend the work of, I know Beacon has done a lot of work in my district, in particular in Edina, trying to get the 60 West project moving forward. And those dollars do go to projects like that, and it's still a competitive process. So they also leverage private dollars. So these programs are not just completely funded by the state. They do a great work to leverage the faith-based community and other businesses to, you know, provide the funding to make these projects work and move forward. So I just wanted to highlight the great work that they're doing, and in particular in my district. So thank you, Ms. Blondes, and thank you, Senator Wicklund, for supporting this. I'm a co-author for obvious reasons, so I would like to move the bill for possible inclusion.
Okay. First, we'll check and see if there's any other questions of members. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question in the whole competitive grants process. Are we measuring outcomes for these folks 2 years after they go into supportive housing? Are they on their own? We talk about evidence-based practices. That's the front end. That's the design of the system. What is actually happening to people as they come out? I hope that's part of the competitive grants questioning, but I'm not seeing how many people we've sort of taken off the homeless rolls in a permanent way.
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I can answer a little bit of that. With Hearth Connection actually applies for the grant and then works with intermediaries and other organizations around the state and actually acts as the evaluator, because it's hard for small organizations to do like tons of evaluation. I mean, that takes some infrastructure there. So that's all set up through Hearth Connection. And they do measure things, not just, you know, how stable is their housing, but also have we prevented other things such as hospitalizations, you know, going into a mental health crisis. We find, especially with the supportive housing grants for people with mental illness, we're actually measuring that more than, in some ways, are they moving off the program altogether, because we're providing a small amount of support to them, which is still hugely, you know, cheaper, frankly, than even one day of hospitalization. So they do look at a wide variety of measures.
And
Senator Benson.
And Ms. Abderholden, is that available? Is it in the Hearth Connection, like on their website, so I can go find it?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I don't know offhand if it's on the website, but I will get you that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator?
No, I just can affirm that, especially for Hearth Connection, because I'm familiar with that one in particular, that they were a pilot project at first, and the study was related to not how quickly did they get off the housing, Senator Benson, but were they able to demonstrate reduced jail incarcerations, hospitalizations for emergency physical care, mental health care, and chemical dependency treatment, and a variety of other costs that the state was paying in relationship to that person, because it was a wraparound service. Hearth Connections is a wraparound service. So that's probably, I don't know if that's the case with the grant process, but I know for Hearth Connections, it was specifically designed to demonstrate how wraparound services could, and a little more investment in the housing could help reduce the costs in other areas of the budget.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony, either in support or opposition, to Senate File 551? Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves Senate File 551 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Wicklund. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.